This is Physics 2710, Introductory Modern Physics, and the date is the 20th of February, 2007. Well, this chapter is, I think, quite a bit more mathematically intense than previous chapters, and fairly dense in that you can't skim through it, in my opinion. And I sent out a little email earlier today suggesting that you pay a special attention to the examples that are worked. I find that they have chosen excellent examples to illustrate their point, and they make important points in their own right, that if you skip the examples, I think you miss some important things. And we did a couple of those examples last time, and we kind of ended up right here, where we talked about the properties of valid wave functions. And we'll see why these become important, because we want to compute the wave functions for certain cases. Miles says this is what he precisely wants to hear about, is what it means to compute the wave function for different potential situations. And so that's kind of where we're headed.
What is potential thing? Wait, what did you say? Say that again.
What do you mean by potential, different potentials?
We mean by potential very similar to what we meant in the other class. I think right now we probably want to talk about
we can't explain it any further.
Electrons or electric potentials, charged particles. I guess in some sense it could be any other kind of potential too. It could be a gravitational potential. In the other class, I tried to very carefully distinguish between potential energy and potential. However, that gets erased, and that they're very sloppy about that in this book and in most places, because right here we see that there's lots of places we could look, but this is the first one that I stumbled on, where you see they have to have the same dimension or same units, E and V. So actually, in a sense, it's kind of the potential energy. And we can use that in a couple of derivations. So for now, think of it as potential energy. But it's going to be a function of position. Potential energy will be a function of position.
Okay.
And possibly could be a function of time, although we hope not so much. I don't know if that was helpful or not, but my other comment would be that to some extent, you just have to feel this a little bit. That's most of it. We're not seeing the whole thing. You're not seeing the title at the top, but I don't know why. We usually see most of it okay. Here's Miles's word again. And if it doesn't depend on time, then that means we can assume that the wave function is separable. If you remember from differential equations, if we talk about some function that is a function of two different variables, but if we have reason or justification or it works out later or whatever, if you know the end from the beginning, if it turns out, maybe you can express it as a product of two different functions, each of which is a function of only one of the two variables. I think I mentioned last time that we use this capital Psi for a function of x and t, and when we do the separation of variables, we use lowercase psi as the function of x, and then this f is the function of t. How many of you have had differential equations?
In it.
You're in it now. You've had it before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you talked about separation of variables?
Yeah, that's one of the ways to do it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you apply...
Well. These guys are in differential equations right now.
Hey, I had it.
One of them is...
That's a thing. I've had so little to do with them for so many years.
I understand.
How do you remember?
It's definitely tough.
Remember a little.
Yeah. Well, to put your mind at ease, Teresa, some students take this class that have neither had it nor are enrolled in it.
Yeah, that's good.
Not this year, but I had some like that last year. And they survived. In fact, they all got good grades, so.
Well, actually, the saving thing is they don't actually make you solve them.
So far, that's really kind of true. We'll be seeing some techniques and things, but we won't be solving them from scratch. If you plug in this product of two functions of a single variable apiece as cap psi into your Schrodinger equation, what we had over here was partial of total psi, of cap psi. But if we're taking it with respect to t, then little psi of x is a constant. So we actually just took this product right here and plugged it in for cap psi, which was right here. But we can factor out or take out of the partial derivative the lowercase psi because it has no dependence on t, and we're only taking the derivative with respect to t. Miles?
Jeremy asking lots of dumb questions. So the lowercase psi, what is that and what is the f? What's a function of place in our, place, I guess, I don't know. And what's a function of time?
What are the functions?
Yeah.
Just general ones that you can plug in?
Right now, we don't know.
Oh.
But we will get there.
Okay.
And in fact, it's going to depend on this potential function over here. We're actually going to look for various cases, various situations of what lowercase psi of x will be given different types of potential situations. And if they are not a function of time, then we don't have to worry about f of t so much. Okay, where's the cursor? All right, there we go. Anyway, do you understand the math here, why we can pull out little psi? Because it's not a function of t, and that's the derivative we were taking. Similar argument would be made over here. We had the second partial of big psi, but since f doesn't have any x's in it, and we're taking the derivative with respect to x, it comes out as well. And so we have the second partial with respect to little psi, because that's the only part that has an x dependence that we're trying to take the derivative with respect to. And then we had cap psi here as well, and we just replaced it with little psi and f. Now, if you divide the whole thing through by the product, divide everything through by this product, we'll get, that'll cancel, and we'll get a f of t on the denominator there. The f of t will cancel, and we'll get a psi of x in the denominator there. You can see where that came from and that came from. And these are now gone if we cancel them off, and so we just have b of x. So far, so good. Leading you through a little bit of math here. Notice that the left side of this equation now, what we've accomplished compared to this up here, this had an x and a t in it, but by dividing the whole equation through by this product, we've actually accomplished an important goal in that the left side is now only, everything on the left side is only dependent on t, and everything on the right side has only x dependence in it. If you make a claim about a differential expression on the left side with respect to one variable, and another differential expression on the right side with respect to a totally different variable, the only way these can always be equal to each other is if they are both equal to a constant. We actually use that technique or trick a few times in this kind of stuff. Here's maybe our first exposure to it, but the only, I think you do that in differential equations too. If all the t stuff is always, not just once in a while or in certain places, but always equal to this x stuff. So no matter what t is, it's always equal to this stuff. The only way for that to be happening when they're totally different variables is for each of them to be equal to the same constant. Pausing for dramatic effect. Hoping it sinks in. Everybody okay with that?
That makes sense.
Okay, if we set the left side equal to this constant and the right side equal to the same constant, we can come up with some very interesting things. This determines the first answer to Miles' question is what is f? If we integrate, let's go back right here, we've taken this left side, and we'll just drop the parentheses because we know that f is a function of t, and set it equal to some constant b. Now, the way to solve for this is to integrate with respect to t. Throw an integral on both sides, we have df over f. Our constant b is now going to be integrated with respect to t. Bring these constants down underneath here, and you end up with this. The integral of that's ln of f, and so that's where we are right now. If ln of f is this stuff, then f must be an exponential, and so we now know the answer to Miles' question. What's f? It's e to the negative ibt over h bar. That also is equal to the energy. Remember our energy operator, our e hat? Well, we'll see that again when we get it out of there. IH bar, partial with respect to time, is the energy operator. So that becomes this side of the equation. This is the other side of the equation that we left before. And then we've thrown on
a psi, a little psi of x on each term to arrive at this thing. And this is known as the time-independent Schrodinger wave equation. By the way, that Schrodinger wave equation would have been sufficient for the quiz today. That would have been a good answer. Mm-hmm. Or wave mechanics would have been enough.
Schrodinger.
Or wave equation, any of those kind of things, as opposed to the matrix. Notice that there's no T in here at all. And that is because we assumed we could get away with the separation of variables. And the other assumption we made is that the potential is not depending explicitly on time. Right here, we said, and I don't think we said this earlier, but there's no T inside of this argument. V is not a function of T. We're making that assumption right here. That's the only way you get to this independent, time-independent equation. But it's something that does happen. That is to say, if you've got a situation where the potential is fixed, it might vary in space, but it's staying the same way throughout time, then you can apply the simpler version of the Schrodinger wave equation and try to determine what these psi functions ought to be, what the wave functions would be for different time-independent potentials. This would be a great time to ask questions.
Like gravitational, that kind of, because that doesn't matter of time. Is that kind of what we're...
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, we wouldn't apply Schrodinger's equation to gravitational situations, but the idea that there's a potential, gravitational potential, well, we talked about a marble in a bowl and the negative derivative is equal to the force. Yeah, that applies here too.
Where would we see differences, whereas if we applied this opposed to the other wave equation or classical ideas, I guess?
The time independent versus the original one that had a dependence on time on it. If you have a system that's actually unfolding in time so that it's changing, so things are moving around and the potentials are changing shape,
mm-hmm.
then you can't use this equation. But the cases that we're going to consider in this chapter in some detail the next hour, we're going to assume that things aren't, whatever it is that's creating the potential well isn't changing its shape or size at this point, so that we will be able to use this time-independent equation. You'll see what I mean when we examine the individual cases. Any other questions? I know Miles feels like I'm putting him off and not answering his questions, but they're very difficult questions to answer in the first place. And second, I think the best way to get at them is to just plow ahead.
Okay.
This is F right here, e to the minus I omega t. We said that it was this right here, but if you plug in what B has to be, then it turns out to be e to the minus I omega t. So that's the F of t. This is the separation of variables. There's the spatial part, lowercase I, and there's the time part, F of t. It's right there. Now, the probability density, remember we were going to take the complex conjugate and multiply it by the original function itself. If you do that with this case, what's the complex conjugate of this? Well, there's no i's in there. So the complex conjugate of this part is e to the plus I omega t. So that's where those terms come from. Since we're multiplying these two together, we get a psi squared. Positive I omega t, negative I omega t, those go away. That's e to the zero. And we end up with this thing right here. That is to say, you can just square the function. Same thing you'd get if the probability density is if it's time independent.
Is there like a good physical explanation for that, or is that just something that seems to fit it well?
A good explanation for what in particular?
Why the probability would just be the square of the function.
Do you remember these graphs that we
uh-huh.
addressed in some detail?
Yeah.
We said these were probability density functions as well,
mm-hmm.
and they're just the psi squared. That'll tell us how likely it is to find an object at a particular place. As far as the physical explanation, that's probably as good as I can do right now, but switch back to the computer. And as far as the mathematical explanation, again, it's because we made this assumption that we could separate the variables. We then worked on it and found out what F had to be, and when you do the complex conjugate, then that just drops out. The mathematical reason is that becomes 1. If your question is prior to that, why does this represent the probability at all?
Yep, that's what it was.
In the first place?
Because I'm a little behind on the questions. These are supposed to be last week's questions.
Yeah, well, let's see if we can read here. Bottom of page 175. In general, psi of x, y, z, and t is a complex quantity and depends on all spatial coordinates as well as time. Complex nature is of no concern to us. We use psi times its complex conjugate when finding probabilities. The value of the wave function psi has no physical significance itself, and as we will learn later, it can have complex value. The quantity psi squared, absolute value, is called the probability density and represents the probability of finding the particle in a given unit of volume at a given instant of time. You want a justification for why that's the case?
I was wondering, yeah.
We can't observe psi itself because it's often complex and you can only observe real quantities. Psi itself seems to have no direct physical meaning as far as what you can measure. Why this squaring thing leads to something that's significant, I guess a mathematical explanation is that when you do not just square it, but if you do psi star times psi, you'll always end up with a real thing, and that might be a measurable.
It just seems kind of weird that, I don't know, you have this wave equation, and then to find the probability that it's at a point, you just square it, and then that's given the probability. I don't know, that just seems kind of weird to me.
I understand why you say it seems weird. It just works. How about that? I mean, I don't think I'm answering your question any better, but equation 6.6 on page 188, I guess I'm trying to make an argument by repetition, but page 188, equation 6.6 says all over again that the probability is a function of x is equal to psi star times psi, and then when you normalize it, you've got to make sure that if you integrate probabilities over everything, it has to equal 1 if you're over the whole universe. The only other justification I can give you right now is that it just works. I mean, it's all consistent when it comes out in the wash at the end of the day. This all really fits together.
I guess, I don't know, maybe part of my question is this like they've just observed it and it seemed to fit this and by coincidence, or, I mean, somebody's actually looked at the physics of it and said, okay, calculating the probability that will be here, and they've done it, and then it turns out to be this. Does that make sense? Which direction it's coming from?
I guess I like your second statement more than your first, except that I don't know how anybody would compute the probability.
That's what I was wondering. It
seems
like
this is how it's done. This is how you do it.
That's confusing. Okay.
Okay, I'm going to leave you unsatisfied.
All right.
Maybe it'll fill in later. So, leaving Miles' excellent fundamental question aside, if we can accept that this is going to give us some kind of indication of the probability at a position x, then notice that this doesn't have any t's in it. This did, but they went away. This whole factor turns out to be 1. So for a situation where the potential isn't changing, then you get a type of standing wave. That we call them stationary states in this context, but it's very similar to the idea of a standing wave that we had back in strain waves in the other class. They just sit there. They're not evolving in time. That's why we call them stationary states. And when you looked at a standing wave, they just kind of sat there too. The nodes didn't move. The anti-nodes moved a lot, but you could kind of take a picture, and the anti-nodes always stayed where they were. You know, the particle was moving up and down, but it didn't shift over. The anti-node was always where it was. The nodes were always where they were. And that was, in a sense, kind of a standing wave. Well, now with the terminology is stationary state, but it's a very similar concept. They make the comment here that classical physics only appears to be more precise because it's making claims about macroscopic things that you can measure easily with traditional equipment. And that kind of roughs over the uncertainties that we get at the microscopic quantum level. But in reality, the most we can know is from Schrodinger's wave equation and not. Expectation values. I think we have thing about expectation values. Here's just an average of a bunch of measurements of the same thing. If you want to know what the average value is, well, if you measure it to be 3 7 times, that would be 7 times 3. You measure it to be 4 9 times, that would be 9 times 4. And then you'd have to add up all of the times you measured it and divide by that. You know how to take an average. That's a kind of a weighted average, where n is how many times you measured a particular value for a discrete variable, but if you do that for a continuous variable, that needs to turn into an integral. So how many times, what's the probability multiplied by x? That's analogous to this. You see that turn in the integral sign. That turns into the probability. This is kind of how many times it occurred. This is how many times it's going to occur. And then the x shows up there as well. And then the denominator is the normalization condition. And that's the same thing we had right there. You have to divide that out to get it normalized average. In quantum mechanics, we do the same thing, in a sense. We don't use a bar. We use these brackets, these angle brackets, to represent the expected value, or the value you'd most expect to see. It's kind of like the most common occurrence when you make multiple measurements. What's the most likely thing to turn up? And you should see that the x is in the numerator and not in the denominator, and this is a normalizing factor in the denominator. Make sure that it's all normalized properly. Now, up here, we stuck x. I think our book sticks it here, doesn't it? Yeah, equation 618 is this very equation right here, only they have the x in front. It doesn't matter much there, but it might matter on other functions. That is to say, the x is just x, but you might want to find out the expectation value. That would be a measurable thing for other quantities, not just x, but like energy or momentum. You might want to know what their expectation values are. What's the energy of the system or the momentum of the system? Well, the only thing you can characterize it by is its expectation values. And in that case, in order to get this all to work out right, you'll see why in a minute, this must go in the middle. It can't go here at the end, or as in our book, here at the beginning. It's got to go in the middle, between the psi star and the psi. It's the only way it works. So remember to stick your g of x in the middle. Why does that matter? It seems like these things ought to be commutative, right? They ought to just be able to move back and forth. They're just factors multiplied back together, right? Wrong. These g of x's are going to be these operators that we had on the quiz. And they'll be differential operators. And they're going to operate on psi. And so it has to be written right here so that it can operate on psi and then have psi star be multiplied by that. So that's why the placement is important, because that could be an operator. Okay, our book goes through a fairly detailed derivation of these two operators. We've got it on the screen here. This is the same thing that's in our book. If you take the derivative of your lowercase psi with respect to x, this is what your lowercase psi is. If you take the derivative of that with respect to x, then psi pops out again, and you also get chain rule, an I and a k out in front from the chain rule. But if you remember what k equals, the wave number, is related to the wavelength, 1 over 2 pi of the wavelength. Do you remember our discussion way back when we first talked about matter waves and having wavelength and the relation between momentum and the wavelength of matter? Actually, we got this from the derivative of this, but now the next step to get to here is just replacing this k with the momentum over h bar. And that works because k is 2 pi over lambda, and that's where the 2 pi on the h bar comes from. It all works out. K is p over h bar. So that's just one more replacement to get to here. And so now if you kind of look at this, say p on psi is equal to, we have, let's see, just a little bit, ip over h bar times psi equals the very first thing that was on the screen on the computer, which was partial with respect to x of psi. If we multiply both sides of this equation by h bar, we'll have ip psi equals h bar partial with respect to x of psi. And then how should we do this? The algebra 10 students would go crazy trying to figure this out, but let's multiply by negative I. That actually turns that into a 1. You could also divide by I. That'd be the same thing. Multiplying by negative I is the same thing as dividing by I. But what that does is get rid of that. And so now we have P times psi equals negative I. That's where that came from. H bar. So what we're claiming is that something called momentum multiplied by psi is equal to this stuff operating on psi. Notice this isn't so much a multiplication as it is an operator. An operator is something that takes one function as an input and produces another function as an output. Think of that as the definition of a mathematical operator. A subclass of that would be differential operators. There's a whole bunch of differential operators, and those would be things that take one function and as an input and do some type of derivative on them, maybe some other stuff too, and then produce another function as an output. This is an example of a differential operator. That is to say, you take the function psi and you take its derivative with respect to x, then you do a couple other little things with it, like multiply by h bar and negative I, and that gives you a new thing, and it equals p times psi. Now, if you've done a lot of linear algebra or differential equations, this won't be incredibly difficult to understand, but I want to highlight that it's kind of an interesting deal, because this seems to be like a constant multiplied by psi, and yet the thing in the box is not a multiplied by psi thing, it's a operator, it's operating on psi. You do this stuff to psi, and you end up with psi itself multiplied by p.
So h bar is
this
like
is like an eigen equation.
So the
eigenvalue thing.
The I h bar is more of like a constant type of thing in front of it.
Yeah, it is part of this particular differential operator, but in that case, yeah, these are just simply multiplied by whatever you get from the differential operator. That means that we can actually take this and this and say, hey, you know, there's a psi and there's a psi. This thing on psi is the same thing as this thing on psi. We're now going to make the leap and actually call that an operator and label it with a hat to indicate that it is an operator. Say this is now the momentum operator. It is a differential operator which says take some function, run it into the input side of the machine, take its derivative with respect to x, multiply by h bar, multiply by negative I, and that's what this does. That is to say, if you operate on some function, that is exactly what we wrote up there. See what I'm doing? This little hat thing now says we're going to use this as an operator. We're going to operate on this function. It's going to produce a new function. And this operator is exactly what we wrote up there as the momentum operator. Now, how did we come up with this momentum operator? Why is this differential operator the one we call the momentum operator? Why isn't it some other operator that we call the momentum? What does this have to do with momentum? Well, I again emphasize that it came out of our wave equation that we happened to take a derivative of. Here's our wave function. If you take the derivative of that, we get from the chain rule, the I and the k come out in front, and there's psi. So we have a differential operator operating on psi, and we get ik times psi. Well, that k turns into a p over h bar, and that's where all of this came from. So it actually came out logically. It's not that someone thought or sat around and said, well, gee, I think some operator ought to be the p operator. Let's assign it to this one. No, it comes out naturally, or it's kind of forced to be that way. What if we did a different derivative? What if we took the derivative of psi with respect to t instead of x? Would that give us anything important or interesting? Well, I don't know. Why don't we try it? Let's just see. If we change this partial derivative to a partial with respect to t instead of x, then what comes out of the chain rule? An I and a negative omega come out instead of an I and a k. So we'll get negative I omega psi. And guess what? Do you remember the energy of a photon? E equals hf. F is really nu, and nu is 2 pi times omega, and so this omega turns into E over h bar. Kind of a similar way we made the k turn into a p over h bar. So now we make the same claim. Multiply this and this by h bar, and then multiply by I, and that makes that one go away. So now all we have left over here is E times psi. That's this part right here. But we've multiplied by h bar up there, and we've multiplied by I to get rid of that right there, and now we have this. Now, instead of thinking of this as some monolithic quantity that can't be broken up, you should think of this as the partial with respect to t operating on psi. In fact, sometimes we even write the psi out here instead of up here on the numerator. And you just have the operator thing, partial with respect to t operating on psi. I want you to kind of think of it that way and remember it that way. So we have constants in there again, sure. But we have a differential operator that when you take a psi function in as an input and do this stuff to it, what do you get out? You get E times the same function. So you can define all that stuff that you did to it as the E hat differential energy operator. Okay, rather than have me... I'll make one more comment about these expectation values, and I want you to work through equation 6.5 in your book together, but let's look at the screen for just another second here. Notice now that P hat, the operator, the momentum operator, is between psi star and psi, and it has to be that way because it's an operator, and it has to have something to operate on. You can't have P sitting over here at the end not operating on anything. If you want to find out what the expected value of the momentum is, you put its operator in here, it's going to operate on psi, and then you multiply it by psi star and do the integration, and you get the answer. Well, this is that part, okay? P acting on psi is the differential operator, and there's the other piece of it, too. Those are constants, so they come out. But if you actually knew what the function was, and Miles asked that question earlier, too. He said, what's little psi and what's little f? I've told him what little f is. We still don't know what little psi is because we haven't said the particular situation that we want to solve it for. But we're going to do some special cases. That was on the quiz, too. Which potential was not discussed in this chapter? Well, we will do the infinite square well. We do the finite square well. We also do the harmonic oscillator. We do not do the sinusoidal well. So there's the answer to the quiz. But in each different case, we'll end up with different psis, which you must actually physically plug into this integral and do the integration, and you'll find out what the expectation value for P is. Similarly for E, goes in the middle so that it can operate on psi, but the energy operator is the partial respect to T, you see that there, and then it had the IH bar, which we pulled out front, outside of the integral. Are we done? Well, that, you know, we're done as far as we can go at this point, but if you apply this to a certain specific situation, then you'll know what the psis are. You can physically plug them in and actually really do the integral and find an expectation value for E, and we'll do some of those too. Okay? Now, this little screen here somehow left out the dividing line between the fractions, but that's what I want you to do. That's equation 6.5. But I'd like you, four, if you can talk to Teresa and involve her, to, it's not going to take a long time. It's not like a 20-minute quiz or anything, but just for 2 minutes, go through example 6.5 on page 194 and see how you take these operators that we've just talked about and you plug them back in and you end up with the Schrodinger equation again. So it's a consistency check.